You are listening to the IFH Podcast Network. For more amazing filmmaking and screenwriting podcasts, just go to ifhpodcastnetwork.com.
Welcome to the Indie Film Hustle Podcast, episode number 622. The most honest form of filmmaking is to make a film for yourself. Peter Jackson.
Broadcasting from the back alley in Hollywood, it's the Indie Film Hustle Podcast, where we show you how to survive and thrive as an indie filmmaker in the jungles of the film biz. And here's your host, Alex Ferrari.
Welcome, welcome to another episode of the Indie Film Hustle Podcast. I am your humble host, Alex Ferrari. Today's show is sponsored by Rise of the Filmtrepreneur, how to turn your independent film into a profitable business. It's harder today than ever before for independent filmmakers to make money with their films, from predatory film distributors ripping them off to huckster film aggregators who prey upon them. The odds are stacked against the indie filmmaker. The old distribution model of making money with your film is broken, and there needs to be a change. The future of independent filmmaking is the entrepreneurial filmmaker or the filmtrepreneur. In Rise of the Filmtrepreneur, I break down how to actually make money with your film projects and show you how to turn your indie film into a profitable business. With case studies examining successes and failures, this book shows you the step-by-step method to turn your passion into a profitable career. If you're making a feature film, series, or any other kind of video content, the Filmtrepreneur method will set you up for success. The book is available in paperback, ebook, and of course, audiobook. If you want to order it, just head over to www.filmbizbook.com. That's filmbizbook.com. Well, guys, today on the show, we have returning champion, Ulrich Bursell. And Ulrich is not only the co-host of the popular Making Movies is Hard podcast, but he's also a filmmaker in his own right. And we're here to talk about his new film, The Alternate, but we also talk about the state of independent film, because I believe that both of us have our hand on the pulse of what's going on in the indie world, you know, sub $1 million budget indie world. And it was a really fascinating conversation. I can't wait for you guys to hear it. So without any further ado, please enjoy my conversation with Ulrich Bursell. I'd like to welcome back to the show returning champion, Ulrich Bursell. How you doing, Ulrich?
Feeling good. Thanks for having me, Alex. I'm like so stoked to be back, man.
Yeah, man. Thanks for coming back on the show, man. I'm excited to talk about your new film, The Alternate, which is, I know, a long gestating project.
Yeah. I think the last time I was on the show, I was like in crowdfunding, like super sweaty, super nervous, just like, please help me make this movie, people. Please. Dear God.
Please help me. Please. Oh, sir, can I have another cup of porridge?
It happened, though. So thank you, everyone.
So I wanted to have you on the show, not to only talk about your new film, but I think it's a great opportunity to talk about the state of independent film, because it changes so rapidly, so often in our business. I mean,
yeah,
God, I mean, it's from the 90s on, it's been so 80s on basically, but the 90s on, it's really just changed so much. And it seems to be changing faster and faster every month. There's something new showing up, some new service coming up, some new way to make money, some new way we're getting screwed by somebody or some company or something. So there's always something. So I'd love to hear your opinion on, from your point of view, and from, you know, obviously you do the interviews on Making Movies is Hard and with Liz, and you guys are kind of have on the pulse as well as I am on what's happening in the indie world. So in your opinion, what do you think, where do you think the state of independent film is, sir?
Well, I guess let's like try to define it a little bit better. Like, do you mean like indie film with like anybody, like including like known, well-known filmmakers, like, you know, the Darren Aronofskys of the world and people who are like making indie film, quote unquote, on their own, but like have budgets and things? Are you talking about like the little, you know, people who are just...
Let's just put it this way. How many Darren Aronofskys are listening to us right now?
Right. Exactly.
It just
frustrates me because like you look at fucking IndieWire or whatever, or some of these places, and they're like indie film. And then they just start quoting all these like $5 million, $10 million movies. And you're like, that's not really what indie film is. Like, indie film to me is like million or under, you know, and people who are just scraping their budgets together, like don't necessarily have any massive talent. No one would know who they are, you know, like that's kind of where I see like indie film. It's like the movies that like, you know, XYZ is picking up, you know, and like, you know, companies like that, like the smaller and
A24s. Stuff. Yeah. The A24s of the world.
Barely. Although A24 is like, if you get to A24 level, you're kind of already cusping onto the,
I'm seeing a bunch of the A24 films lately. And there are some that I have no idea other than the director, who the hell they are. So there are those, but then there's of course, the Everything Everywhere All at Once crowd as well.
Olivia Wilde's movies and stuff, you know, it's just like, you know, Booksmart, et cetera. It's like, you know, come on. I mean, like, I feel like A24, like maybe they are picking up some stuff that's like, you know, from these unknown, like struggling filmmakers. But I think for the most part, like if you get on their radar, it's like you've kind of ascended to like another scope than, you know, the majority of indie filmmakers.
Yeah,
another
exactly.
Sphere, I should say.
So no, I think to answer your question, I do think that like the Whale and you know Darren Aronofsky's film that's coming out, and a bunch of other films that, you know, Everything Everywhere All at Once is quote unquote an indie film, and I would say it is, because I talked to the boys and it wasn't a $500 million movie though.
Right.
It was basically the craft service budget of Doctor Strange, and they both tackled the multiverse in a very different way. So I think the state of independent film, I think the artistic state at that level is going strong. There's still a place for it. It's harder now, I think, to even be seen than it was 5 years ago, 10 years ago. But I'm talking more about the state of independence, like the alternate, like that kind of film.
Well, yeah, I mean, I feel like, you know, what I'm seeing is that, you know, you really hustle your ass off to make your movie, you know, and then like if you're lucky, you get into like some really great film festivals, you know, and then if you're like the 1%, you get into like, you know, South by Southwest or these game changing film festivals that like, you know, agents and managers are suddenly paying attention to you and you're getting those kinds of offers, and then your career is like whatever, you know. But that's like such a small percentage of filmmakers. That's like, yeah, like literally the 1%, you know. And then everyone else, it's like you're basically you get into those film festivals, you're trying to get the best absolute distribution deal you possibly can, and then, you know, you get pumped out until the digital marketplace, most likely. Maybe you get on a streamer. Maybe you get on a streamer eventually later down the line in the life of your movie, but it's kind of like you're just out in the ether, and that's sort of up to you to do the promotion and to get people to watch your movie. And then in that case, if you go with a distributor, it's, you got to like split the profits and everything. But I think, you know, with going with a distributor, you get like a lot of other bonuses, you know, like not getting paid
and
like access
depends.
I mean, you could probably hire the same PR team that your distributor's hiring, you know, whatever, and do it on your own and pay that money up front. But like having that kind of support and the infrastructure can be helpful. Like we did get a lot of access, you know, to different outlets through them, and mm-hmm. Our trailer ended up picking up like, you know, 160,000 plus hits, you know, on YouTube, kind of through like the work that team did of like, you know, hitting up all these different channels and like getting the word out on the movie. So I think like to some extent, like unless you want to be like, you know, managing a PR firm yourself and then paying that cost up front, which is like, you know, you already spent all this money making the movie. Like, do you really have another $5,000 to pay a PR team out of your own pocket, you know, when you're going to distribute? Maybe you do, you know, if you want to do self-distribution. But I basically feel like, I guess the state of what I'm saying is that, you know, even at the highest, like even at like a level of success that is like really exciting and acceptable, we're kind of all in the same playing field still, you know? And like, it's like kind of up to the filmmaker to get the word out in their movie and to, you know, have it, you know, recoup its investment, hopefully. And then if not, like, you know, at least get you onto your next project. So I feel like that's sort of what the first feature I really feel like is useful for, is like, you know, using that as like, you know, what your short film used to be. Like your short film used to be your calling card. Now I feel like your first feature is your calling card. Getting those reviews, like, you know, on Rotten Tomatoes, and like getting a Rotten Tomatoes rating, or, you know, at least just getting some positive reviews from some sort of critic. It's like, that's all ammunition you can use to make your next movie. Like when you're approaching investors and approaching production companies, you can point to your successes.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
And then that can be like, okay, well, here, now trust me to, you know, take a little bit more money and go make my next movie, you know?
So is the first feature, in your opinion, a loss leader? Or is there some?
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, yeah. I mean, I feel like there is like some potential, but I think especially as a filmmaker, like you're definitely not expecting to get any kind of payment on the first feature. You know, if you're lucky to get your investors' money back, but like you as yourself, like you're not going to get any kind of payment. You
know? But isn't that? I mean, look, I know we look at things from the artistic filmmaker insanity, carny world that we live in. It is insane.
Right.
I mean, there's a delusion that we have ingrained in us at a DNA level to be even in this business. But on a business standpoint, you look at it and like, it makes our business is so insane that you right. go out and spend $100,000 on a product and have no idea truly how to make that money back.
Yeah, or $1 million.
Or $1 million.
Right.
You know, hopefully, if you're at the $1 million stage, you've got a few things in place to guarantee something.
But it seems like a lot of people, even at the $1 million range, are kind of in the same boat as the $100,000 range. It's like, I think when you get to the pre-sale deal and you're like making a deal with a distributor before you make the movie and they're giving you an MG before you even, you know, go out and shoot anything. I think that's kind of where like it actually makes a little bit more sense business-wise, where you're like not just like, you know, hemorrhaging money into a project. But, you know, getting those deals isn't easy, you know, and you have to have the right cast set up and everything. I mean, I've seen it done a lot, you know, and like have people on the show and like talk to other people who like, this is what they do. But it's definitely not like as easy as it sounds, you know, it's pretty hard to get that kind of, you know, that magic little deal to happen.
Right. Exactly. And it is all those kind of deals are all star based. They're not artistic based. They're not like
oh, the you script almost really doesn't even script. Matter.
It means obviously we've seen a lot of Nick Cage movies, Bruce Willis movies.
It just has to be like the right genre. It has to have like the right number of thrills. It has to feature the star enough. And it's like it's got to hit some beats. But besides that, like, yeah, it can be whatever.
You know? Yeah. And it's that. I mean, I'm going to AFM this year. Are you going to AFM this year? Uh-uh. I'm going to be at
my AFM movie will be year. Out there though with Multivisionaire. So if anyone's at AFM and looking for a sci-fi thriller in the international market, yeah, we'll be out there on the booth, you know, Buck Sean.
So, you know, Bob, I'm going to be out there at AFM this year. And every time I go to AFM, it's just, it's an absolute education for people to go out there because even if they have no movie, just to walk around to see how movies are sold. It's
crazy.
But you have been there, right?
I've been there. Yeah, I went once and I was foolish enough to think that I could try to raise money for the alternate before it was made at AFM. Yeah. And I did like 20 pitches to all these different companies and everything. And they told me the same thing. It's like, oh, well, either if you have the budget or you have the cast or cast and half the budget, then we can talk. But if you don't have at least half the budget or cast and, you know, then we don't care.
It's not even a conversation.
And at that point, it's like, well, if I had cast and money, why would I even need you? You know, I would just make the movie.
Exactly. But, you know, I was talking to a client the other day who made a movie at the sub $100,000 range. And they made them and they came to me and they're like, what do you think? And I'm like, you're not going to make a dime. And then they're like, well, what do I do? I'm like, recast one of your parts with a name actor. Go out and get somebody for a day for like 10 or 15 grand and shoot them out in a day, pepper them out through the entire movie, make sure there's enough of him in the movie or her in the movie. And now you've got someone on a thumbnail and now you've got an opportunity to maybe make your money back. But without that person, you're dead in the water. And I just,
maybe.
No, it's not a maybe. It's an absolute fact because of the
The kind of movie. Okay. Yeah.
That's the thing. It depends on the genre. So the genre of the film was not action. It wasn't it wasn't one of those genres. And it wasn't like an art house backyard film. So it wasn't like it didn't have a place to be. So I'm like, dude, the only way you're going to even remotely have a shot is getting a face on the thumbnail.
Yeah.
And he's exactly what he did. We worked and got a name actor. We also worked with a distributor and we went to the distributor and said, hey, give me a list of 10 people who you would be interested in this film if they were in it. We went through the list and we just started knocking them off and making offers until finally one said yes. And wow. We got him, shot him out in the day, peppered him throughout the entire movie. He's like, oh my God, the movie's so much better. I'm like, yes, because you've got a real, like an actor who has real credits, who's a real professional, who's been doing this for years. And now we're going to go into the marketplace, but there's a fighting chance at that point. Right. And it's sub 100,000. It's sub 100,000. Yeah. So it's a good kind of place to be as a filmmaker. Yeah. Is a sub 100,000, because you start going 250, 300, every 10 grand that you go up, you better just know your shit better.
Yeah. No, it's totally like keeping your costs low. It definitely helps the chance of recoupment for sure. You know? And I think like, if you're self-distributing, like if you can make a movie for $50,000, that's you know, a genre film, you know, like an action thriller, horror, sci-fi, whatever. I think the chances of recouping on 50K, you know, especially if you're cutting out all the middle people, is really high. But, you know, then you have to ask yourself, like, what do you want to do with your life? Like, do you want to be, you know, promoting a movie and selling a movie for like 2 years? Like, it's kind of, you know, some people are really into that. And some people like me, like, don't really want to be like, I can spend, you know, like a couple months promoting a movie, but like, I can't do it for a year. You know, that's just too much.
Right. And that's another thing that's really interesting, because before, you know, when you go to film school, they teach you how to make, you know, $100 million movie. And that's what they teach you to that. And they tell you, you could do this. You could be the next Chris Nolan, and that's fine. And you might be, but chances are you're not going to be, because there's only so many Chris Nolans in the world. But I think that before, there was a problem getting into the business because things were so expensive to make. Movies were expensive to make. Getting good high quality was expensive to make. But now that the barrier to entry is so minimal, you could make. I mean, I made my last two features for sub 10,000, and got one of them on Hulu. The other one was sold. Both of them were sold internationally, and I made my money back fairly quickly. But
yeah.
But the
10,000 or less, that's you know getting money back. You got a good chance.
You have a much better chance with, you know, one had more faces in it than the other one did. And the other one had no stars in it, but it was basically experiments for me. It was just kind of like, let's see what happens. And I was expressing myself as an artist and all that kind of good stuff. But I think the problem we have now, it's not that we can't make a movie. It's we can't get our movie seen. So if the filmmaker moving forward doesn't have some plan in place to get the movie in front of eyeballs, to get into, and that's why I wrote my book about, you know, finding a niche, focusing on that niche and trying to build product or build films for that niche, to get in front of the audience. Either you do it yourself, which I agree with you, not everybody's got that thing in them that they can sell. I get that, but they need to have something in place, whether that be working with a PR firm, having a producer who's really good at, partner with someone who's really good at it. And I think the end is that maybe have a distributor. And distributors that I know, and in my experience, they're trying to figure shit out too.
Yeah. No, they're kind of in the same boat as we are, you know?
They don't know what to do either. And they're trying to figure it all out. And I mean, I went to meetings at AFM during that whole distributor debacle when that went down.
Oh my God. Yeah.
And when I broke that story, my face was all over the place. So all these distributors were bringing me in to like try to, you know, woo my apparent like 2,000 or 3,000 filmmakers I pulled together in a Facebook group that were pissed off at the distributor, and they're like, oh, give us those films. And I'm like, okay, yeah, I'll take the meeting. And I would ask them, and they would just tell me their shtick. And I'm like, let me ask you a question. Do you guys have any idea how you're going to make money back on these films? He goes, no, we just throw as much shit against the wall as we can, and something usually sticks. And that was really eye-opening to me when they said that, because it's just, before there was a plan, before there was like, you went to a distributor, they had this, I can go do this, I get money from this, and that still does exist at the 5 million and above, the Nick Cage films, the, you know, 20 million and below, that kind of genre stuff.
Yeah,
that still exists. But for the 100,000 and below, 500,000 and below, million and below, unless there's talent involved, it's very, very difficult for them to try to find a place in the marketplace. And then also for when your movie is done, there's about 3,000 other films sitting, waiting to come in. So
yeah,
they don't spend as much time on your films. Is that is that a fair statement?
I think so.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
Yeah, I mean, I when I was talking to my distributor for The Alternate, like, you know, he definitely had a little bit more care into his thoughts about it, you know, right. And like, he was like, you know, this is a similar to a movie that we had a few years ago. We did really well with it. We think that this has a lot of potential to do the same kind of business, you know, and, you know, he kind of like went in it with that way. And like, they were very strategic of the way they were creating the art. I loved my art that I made. I thought it was beautiful. I have it on my, you know, frame poster over there. But like, you know, they're like, all the distributors, like my international and the US were like, this is just not going to work. You know, this is just, it's not going to sell. And so then they made one. And then like, suddenly that's the one that everyone likes, that their own, the trailer that the distributor made, the US distributor, then the international distributor is using that same poster. And I guess they're having a lot more success with it, with that poster. So it's just really interesting the way it all works and the way the whole business works. And like, what is eye catching? What makes people click, you know, and the theories behind it. But again, in the end, like you said, no one really knows. We won't know if it worked until we see the first quarter, you know, numbers.
I'd argue and that won't be for like numbers.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah.
Yeah. Because you know, AFM's coming up, and then hopefully Cannes will come up after that. And those would be the two big markets that they go to sell your film at.
But right.
It's you just don't know. And that's the other thing you said. You said something that's really important for people listening to understand. One, the poster that made them click, that is something that needs to be in the head of filmmakers, because there's still this magical dreamlike thing with theatrical and all that. And that's wonderful. And we all, you know, many of us grew up with theatrical experience, and I want my movie in a movie. Everything, every filmmaker wants their movie in a theater, because it's the ultimate experience of it. But unfortunately, unless you're Chris Nolan,
right,
you don't have the juice to do that all the time. So you're going to live on a thumbnail.
Yeah, it's not even the best thing for your movie, you know. Exactly. Like, if you make a movie under $1 million, like, you probably don't want to put the movie into theaters, because you're just going to lose all this money paying for that, and like the loss that you're going to get from the theater owners or whatever. And then, you know, in the end, it's like you're taking away juice, as you like to say, from the you know, the online sales, because that's where you're really going to get your money. But if it's like split between a theatrical and you know, the online, like, then you're not going to make as much money online. And you know, like, that's where your real money, I think, is going to come in. So I just feel like the theatrical is like a really beautiful thing. And if the distributor wants to do it and they can make it work or whatever, like, totally great, like, let's do it. But like, you know, I wouldn't push it as a filmmaker. I would let the people who know what makes money and what doesn't make money make those decisions. You know, if they think a theatrical run's good for your movie and you're actually going to see some extra revenue from it, then great. But I just don't think that's 90% of, you know, movies at this budget level, you know.
And isn't it interesting, though, that, you know, in the 80s and the 90s, our films had a movie you would be able to either buy it for $20 on DVD or VHS, or you would get, someone would have bought it and then other people rent it. Then when TVOD showed up, iTunes showed up, then you got $3.99 for your movie and $9.99 for your movie. That was your value of your movie per customer.
Right.
Is that
right?
Before that theatrical, you know, there was a ticket sale and you would get a split of the ticket sales, and that was the value of your movie. Where in today's world, the Netflix effect and the Amazon Prime effect has now brought our product down to less than a penny for a view. And that's what the value in the marketplace is for our films, without a major star or something that brings it up, or niche, or, you know, word of mouth or festival that maybe gives it some sort of juice. But what do you think of that?
I think that's why it behooves you to keep your movie on for sale or rent as long as possible, and like, not go to Prime, not go to these other you know, avenues until you've really exhausted your sales through rentals and in, you know, digital sales, you know, or if you have a DVD or your DVD sales, you know. But I feel like a lot of people, I see this even with people who are doing self-distribution. they just want the movie to be out so people can see it, so they can like say, oh, just click, it's on Prime Video, just click. So they just upload it to Prime and they get it out quickly. And it's like, oh, no, no, no. If you made a movie for even $1,000, like, don't just put it on Prime. Like, make your friends and family or your network rent it or buy it. And then suddenly you're going to get that $1,000 back, you know? But if you just put it on, like you said, you're never going to get not even $1,000. Like, you're never going to get $1,000 back on Amazon Prime. I mean, maybe after like 5 years, you know?
Not even. It's literally they're trying to get fractions of a penny now. Like, they gotten down to a penny and they're figuring out if they need fractions of a penny for certain films. But the place that I've seen and I've been talking about for a while now is AVOD. AVOD seems to be the place where there is money still to be made. And even more so, the next level of AVOD and something that the filmmakers are really, like, their egos get really twisted in a knot because of this, is YouTube. If you can get on these YouTube movie channels that have 1 million, 2 million, 5 million subscribers and get a piece of that ad revenue, which is, YouTube is AVOD. You know, it's not just Tubi and Pluto. It's Freevee. These are real places. I see the numbers from distributors and I'm like, wow, this is the but AVOD is the place where I still make the most money off of my movies. Yeah. And I think it's kind of hopefully the place where we can make the most money, because at that point it's like someone clicks, and if your movie is good enough and it keeps them playing and watching, you're going to get ad revenue. So it really is about how good your movie is. Have you heard the same thing in your world?
Pretty much. Yeah. I feel like AVOD is becoming like a real crown jewel for returns for films at our level, you know. And some people even recommend, like, just go straight to AVOD. Like, don't even spend time on, you know, the rental and the sales. But, like, I feel like, you know, for certain movies or just, I guess, certain distributors, like, they still feel that that's a real, you know, great place to make, you know, a big chunk of revenue. So they still want the 6 months or whatever, a year or however long it is, like, doing, you know, those sales and then go to AVOD afterwards, you know?
It's really interesting with the whole TVOD thing, because everybody I talk to, nobody makes money on TVOD unless you can drive traffic. Drive traffic. And most distributors don't understand how to drive traffic. So to hold it for 6 months in TVOD is, I feel, unless the numbers are coming in, you're like, oh shit. But TVOD is, just because it's up on iTunes and up on Amazon Prime, Amazon to purchase or rent, unless you can.
And Vudu and all those other places and YouTube and whatnot.
You know. Fandango and all that stuff. Yeah. You get 5 cents from Fandango and, you know, you'd be amazed. But I talked to so many distributors now who are just like, I just want to go to AVOD, and the filmmakers are freaking out. And they go, they just don't understand that that's where the money is. And if you could drive all the traffic from the beginning to AVOD, you'll make more money than you will letting it sit on TVOD, because unless you can drive traffic. Look, I had a success story, a filmtrepreneur success story, Mark Toya, who made $1 million robot, you know, action movie which sounds horrible, in the jungle.
Sounds great to me. I love those kinds of movies.
But that movie, but the reason why that works is because the visual effects were on par with anything that the Marvel Studios has ever put out.
It's, oh, wow.
So good. I can't express to you how good it is. So he had over $1 million deal with a distributor, and he just looked at the contract. He's like, I'm never going to get my money up front. By the way, it was $1 million something up front. And he's like, I'm never going to make my money with the way this contract's laid out. Screw it. I'm just going to self-distribute. And he self-distributed the whole thing. And he's made, I think, at $6 or $7 million at this point. He made all the money back. He made all the money back of the budget in 3 months on TVOD, but he ran Facebook ads. He ran YouTube ads. He understood. He was that PR firm that you're talking about.
Right.
Because he comes from a commercial background and he enjoyed it and it worked fine for him. But it is possible in today's world. And he's still making money. He's still making money. He's like, yeah, I'm going to release another one. I'm going to put another TVOD campaign out. And I'm just, and he's still go while he's in. I don't think he's gone to, I don't think he's gone to AVOD yet. I think he might have gone to, he did go to AVOD on Prime. Yeah, he did do Prime. And but he's like, Alex, I was making, I think he said like 30,000 a month on AVOD, and he was 1 billion minutes stream.
Wow. Wow.
And he's like, this is ridiculous. Why am I getting such little money for so much Amazon is getting? So it's just like, but this is the world that we live in, man. It's crazy.
Yeah, yeah.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
I wonder if he'd, because that was on Prime, right? And getting that kind of the one where it's like, you know, he was getting billions of minutes viewed and then getting $30,000 back. That was Amazon Prime.
Yeah. But then he took it off Amazon Prime. He's like, screw this. Okay. And I'll just, he's not doing any AVOD anymore right now. He might go into the Tubies.
Because I was wondering like what his Tubi numbers must be way better than that. You know, like if he was getting a billion minutes viewed on Tubi, he'd probably be getting lots and lots of money back from that.
I'm not sure. And I have to remember, I'm not sure if he's on Tubi already or he hasn't been on Tubi yet, but that film will be top 10 on Tubi.
What's it called?
Monsters of Man.
Okay, I'll have to look at Monster, check it out.
Monsters of Man. Yeah, I have two interviews with him. The first one was us discussing him going on this adventure to do $1 million self-distribution experiment because he didn't give a care. Wow. He didn't care about the money. And he's like, I screw it, I don't care. And then 2.5 years later, he comes back and he's like, yeah, made about $6-7 million with this. And I'm still going, thank you for your book, Alex. I'm like, oh, Jesus. All right. So there was a wonderful case.
That's a lot. That's a huge return.
But it is a huge return. But he even told me, he's like, I go, is it going to be a sequel? He goes, probably not, because this is not a real business. Because he comes from the commercial world. So he's been doing commercials for 30 years. And he goes, Alex, I make more money on my stock footage than I do doing this stuff, because that's a real business. And I was like, wow. And he's a businessman and he's, you know, owns real estate and other things like that. So it's really interesting to see. And he's been talking to all the big, he won't say who, but we all know there's probably a superhero company or two that's talked to him already. Because what he was able to do, he was top. I think when he went on iTunes, he was like number two. I think Endgame was the only thing ahead of him. And people are like, who the hell is this guy? Where did he come from? Why does this look so good? He did this for how much?
Wow.
Shot them all on Reds. He's like had 3 or 4 Reds with him and shot it all up in the jungles of the Philippines and stuff like that. And never built a set. Everything location.
Wow. Amazing.
These are all great. These are great stories, but that's an anomaly.
I mean, it kind of brings me to like my overall point about independent filmmaking is like, you're not really doing it for the money, right? You're doing it because you want to make movies and because you have stories to tell and this is the thing that you want to do with your life. And I don't think you even think you're doing it to like necessarily start this career that's going to be your main thing forever. I mean, we all hope that's what it ends up being. And we all hope that we get to that level. But I think if you're going out to make an independent film, like you should be just thinking about it as like, you're creating this piece of art that you need to create because you are an artist and you are a filmmaker and you have the story that you have to tell and share with the world and that you want people to see. But like putting any more weight behind this than that, I think you're just going to be let down. Cause like if you're going into it, like trying to make a bunch of money or even getting a return on your investment or, you know, getting an agent or a manager or starting your career where you're going to like start directing television or I'm going to get offers from Marvel or whatever, like all those kinds of things. Like, you know, that's all pipe dream stuff. And I think like if you go into making your movie with those sort of pipe dreams and that's like your expectation, there's nowhere that you can go but down. Like you're only going to be let down from the experience. But if you go into it thinking like, I have this movie I want to make, I'm really excited about it, I love the story, like I really want to get this out to show people, I want my movie to, you know, hopefully inspire someone else to make their movie or like inspire them to think about my characters or my story or whatever it is. If you go into it with that, like you're more than likely going to enjoy the experience because you're probably going to hear from at least one or two people who connected with your movie once you finally finish it and release it, you know? And so I think those are the kinds of reasons we should be going into making a movie. Like we should be focusing on the art itself, like not the outcomes of the art, which are completely out of our control, you know?
That's what I did with my first two movies. I did the exact same thing. I finally, because most of my career, I was under that delusion of like, this short film's going to blow me up or this thing is the thing that's going to take me to the next level.
We all have that, right?
Right. Right. So then I'm like, I'm just going to go make a movie. 30 days later, I was shooting my movie after the moment I said, I'm going to go make a movie. And then that's the one that gets sold to Hulu. And that's the one that gets sold internationally. Wow. And then I shoot that other one at Sundance for 4 days and, you know, and just go and make a movie. I'm like, I don't know what's going to happen with it. As I was flying home, I was like, I don't even have a movie. Like, I didn't have time to see if I shot all the footage I needed. I don't know. I think I did. You know, things like that. So it's kind of like this. When I let go of the outcome, man, it became much easier, much more fun to make movies. But let me ask you this then, why? And I know you've met a lot of filmmakers, and I know you are one as well as I. Why is there so much delusion in this profession? I mean, cookie makers don't have this delusion. Like, I'm going to make the greatest cookie ever. Like, it generally doesn't. It doesn't work in other, right? Like, architects are like, I'm going to make the biggest biggest ever. They go, Frank Lloyd, who? I'm the one. Like, you don't say, I'm sure they do, those people exist.
I think architects may be a little closer than cookie makers, but yeah.
But generally speaking, it's not the infestation in the entire populace of that group of artists is not as delusional as filmmakers and screenwriters for that matter, because what is it about this art form? Painters aren't that. Musicians maybe, but again, there's not that. It's just, I find such a delusion in what we do with so many people. So why do you think that?
Well, I kind of feel like it's embedded in the art form in a lot of ways, you know, like if you look at like, just think of like the classic phrase, like, I'm going to make you a star, kid. You know, it's like, this has been going on since the beginning of cinema. Like this whole idea that like you can be a star on the stage and the screen, you know? And so I think when you're going into making your movie, it's kind of natural to think like, yes, like I could be the next Robert Rodriguez. Like he did it. He scrapped his movie together for $7,000 or whatever. And like, now he's a big star. Like I could be like Robert Rodriguez or Quentin Tarantino or like, you know, all these like complete like outliers in the industry. And it's like, you just, you know, you fall in love with these movies and with these artists, and then you kind of like, you know, start to see like, oh, I could be like that. Like that could be me, you know, and you sort of see your idea of your movie and your art getting to that level. And so I think it's just sort of a natural progression. But I think, you know, it's obviously completely misguided. And I think it's, into some way, it's almost sold to us, you know, like by the filmmakers, by the films Hollywood. Themselves, by Hollywood. It's like this like really enticing, like, yeah, come out to Hollywood and make your fortune. You know, it's like, you know, it's like this whole like sort of thing. And I think, you know, you got to look at, and like maybe back, you know, in the 80s, in the 90s, like it was much more likely that could work out for you in that way. But
less competition, different marketplace. Absolutely. I know every month.
Completely different marketplace.
Yeah. Every in the 90s, every month there was a Richard Linklater, a Spike Lee, a John Singleton, a Robert Rodriguez, a Tarantino, a Kevin Smith. The list keeps going on and on. Almost every month, there was one of these magical stories, Napoleon Dynamite, Joe Carnahan. I mean, it was just constant in the 90s.
I think it was more lucrative back then, too, like with the VHS marketplace, you know, and then turned into the DVD marketplace. Like, I think those two kind of led into each other. And like, it was a way that people could make a movie for zero money, and you could make a big profit, you know, like. And obviously movies cost a lot more back then, so it couldn't be zero, but like you make a movie for like whatever, $500,000, $1 million or something, and then like, you know, get a big profit back. But yeah, it's just not the same anymore. Like, you know, like it's like the whole Napster effect of everything. It's affected films. It's affected everything. You know, all art form is suffering for it. And I think like now you basically can't get that big of a return on a movie so easily. It's like, it's much, much more difficult. And I think, going into it like as a filmmaker, you should just be aware like of what you're up against, and that like these fantastical fantasy outcomes are like so unlikely that they should not at all be embedded in your hopes and dreams for the success of your movie. Like you should definitely try to like it's good to have dreams, it's good to have fantasies, but I think it's good to separate them from the art you're creating. Cause like, you don't want it to be entangled. Cause then you're just going to think that your art sucks if you're not famous after you make it.
Right. And then you go into a depression, and then you just are figuring it out and all this kind of stuff. But isn't it fascinating that I know a lot of people listening to us right now are saying, that's for everybody else. That's not going to be me.
Yeah.
Am I wrong? How many people listening right now have that thought in their head? Like, that's for other people. That's not me.
And well, I'm going to be the one that's different.
But dude, I said the same thing. You said the same thing. I'm sure.
Yeah.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
We all go through this process, and only after years of being battle hardened by the business. And by the way, all of those stories that we're talking about, the Roberts and the Quintons and the Kevin Smiths and all of that stuff, I've had a lot of those guys on the show, and I've talked to them about their struggles at the beginning, and it was real for them at the beginning.
Yeah,
so yeah, they had success, but there was no guarantee for that success. And by the way, the one common thing that I've gotten from all of those kind of like those 90s filmmakers I've had a pleasure of talking to is none of them had an outcome that they had in mind. None of them. Robert wanted to go to the straight video market. That was it. That's all he cared about.
Yeah, he saw that business opportunity. Yeah.
Right. That was it. He wasn't expecting to get signed by Sony and get it. Yeah. He didn't even want El Mariachi to be released. He's like, no. That was just I was going to go straight to video. That's not my first movie. He was freaking out about it. And something like what Ed Burns did with Brothers McMullen, where he was working as a PA at ET, Entertainment Tonight. And they had Robert Redford showed up to do press for Quiz Show. And in the elevator, as the doors are closing, Edward comes in, hands him a VHS copy of Brothers McMullen's Rough Cut. Here, this is my movie, Robert. Please take a look at it. 3 months later, gets a call from Sundance. Yeah, Robert gave us a VHS. How's that movie coming along? Is it almost done? How can you plan that?
That's crazy.
Isn't that insane? Like, you hear these kind of stories, you're just like, but that's the stuff that feeds the delusion, I think. How many people listening right now have to put together a business plan? Probably not a lot, but the people who have put together a business plan to raise money are using these as references of how movies are made. Blair Witch Project,
mm-hmm.
Paranormal Activity, Napoleon Dynamite.
Yeah.
Like, they're using the
you got to take the outliers off your decks, people.
You can't do it. But that's every time I've read a business proposal, if it's a horror movie, absolutely Blair Witch and Paranormal Activity are there.
Yeah.
And Saw.
Yeah, you got to take those out. You got to like look at the movies that are like, you know, not the ones that, you know, completely exceeded expectations and blew up and were special movies of the moment or whatever, you know, like look at like, I don't know, like when I was making my deck for the alternate, I looked at this movie called Spring. I don't know if you've seen Spring, but it's like the sci-fi thriller that was made for, you know, right around the same budget as my movie. It did get to South by Southwest, I believe. And it, you know, it did really well. I think it was an XYZ movie. But like, those are the kinds of movies I was looking at, like ones that were made around for the same budget as mine, you know, didn't have stars like, you know, mine was going to have stars, and like, try to find those movies that look like your movie, but like, don't put a movie in there that doesn't look like your movie, because then you're instantly going to displease and mislead even your investors to, you know, thinking that, you know, you're going to get something that you can never deliver, you know?
Now let's talk about your new movie, The Alternate. How long did this film get? Was gestating, sir, to get made?
Well, so yeah, I wrote the first draft in like, I believe it was March of 2014. So what's that? Like over 8 years until it got
this
released.
This is the insanity. This is the insanity that we live in.
It takes a long time. I mean, and, you know, and I went to AFM to try to sell it or to raise money for it in 2017. And so basically from 2017 till we shot in the end of 2019, that was like when I was like actively working on it and like trying to get it made, you know. I mean, I was still working on it that whole other time, but it was more like just trying to figure things out and, you know, rewriting and, you know, failing at raising money over and over again. But then 2017 is when I raised my first amount of money, and then like met my producer, you know, raised more money, and then eventually, you know, got it made a couple of years later. So yeah,
it's been a while, right? I always love asking this question of filmmakers. What was the, you know, as a director, there's always that day that the entire world comes crashing down around you. And that's generally every day. But, but what was the worst one on this day? What was the worst like moment in the production and how did you overcome it?
Yeah, I think it was the second day maybe of the shoot. And we were setting up the basement office set for Jake. He's got this, you know, really cruddy office that he does his editing in. He's a filmmaker, sort of like autobiographical in some way. And
I was about to say.
Yeah. He's got a big beard, you know, come on, like whatever. I was in charge of the office because I was using my own computers as Jake's computers in the office scene. So I was the one who was, you know, entrusted to, you know, make sure the computers were working and make sure that everything on the screen that needed to be, you know, on the screen was on the screen. And I was having all these issues just trying to get it set up. We were like way behind, like 3 hours behind on the second day in the office. And I had to like go and like at lunch, I had to like buy a hard drive and like go pay, like get some money to pay somebody. Like, because I'm a producer too, so I had to like go to the bank, get like a large amount of money, and like buy a hard drive, and like get back. That was like during lunch, and then get back in a half hour, 45 minutes, or whatever, to like, you know, direct, and then somehow eat at some point. And I was just so upset, man. Oh my god! And I recorded audio logs while I was making the movie. So like on my podcast, Making Movies Is Hard, you can actually hear the log of me like on my lunch break, like talking to the phone and just like freaking out about how everything is going wrong. And how we overcame it. I think I got back to the set after getting those things. I just talked to my DP. I talked to my production designer. And we were just like, look, these are the scenes that we're going to be able to do today. This is what we're going to do. We're going to revise the schedule. I'll talk to my AD, obviously. And we just like sort of broke down how we were going to solve it. We got through the day. I don't think we went over. If we did, it wasn't much. And then, you know, we kind of had to replan the rest of the week to make it work. And I think that was when we added another day to production because we were supposed to be out of the office in 3 days. And I think we ended up shooting in the office scene for 4 because we just had too much we had to do in there. But yeah, I think the way I overcame it was just like having these conversations with my team, breathing, slowing down, and then just, you know, looking at the schedule and then just like going, just checking off things that we don't have time to do, moving them to another day and making a movie, man. And, you know, it ended up working out.
Now, going with the theme of what the alternate is about, which is kind of like alternate universes and the multiverse, that kind of thing. What would you, if you had an opportunity to go back and talk to your younger self, and just for one thing you could tell him and go, okay, dude, this is going to be the trip about your filmmaking career. What is that one thing you wish you would have known at the beginning of your career that was really difficult for you to learn along the way?
That you really just like, you don't need anything special. Like you don't need any like special person or special chip or there's nothing that you can learn that's going to open up the doors and like, you know, make you able to make your movie. Like you just have to make your movie, you know? And I think like once I made the feature, it was sort of like, this is just like making a short, but like, you know, 100 longer. Times harder, you know, it's just like, you know, and it's not like, you know, a short's 10 minutes and the movie's 100 minutes. It's not like 10 times. It's literally 100 times harder to make a feature. But I think if I just had known that you just have to do it yourself, and then the same thing that I did to make my short is the same. It's the same exact process I'd have to do to make my feature. If I just knew that and I knew that I didn't need any special, you know, sign of approval or, you know, manager or agent or big production company or like big check from an investor or whatever. If I knew that it wasn't about that and it was just about doing the same thing I've been doing, I think I might have been able to make the feature a little bit sooner if I had that kind of knowledge and confirmation that it's just like you just need to do it, you know.
Amen, brother. Preach, baby. Preach. I think so many of us always wait for permission too. They permission.
You don't need permission.
Somebody,
yeah.
From somebody to make it. And you, I think I got caught up in that same thing. That's why I was like, I was waiting for permission for 40 years. And I just said, screw it. I'm just going to go make my movie the way I want to go make it. And I'm just going to grab a camera and grab some friends and make a movie. And boy, it worked out. You know, thank God it worked out. But
yeah,
we are. I think that's also built into the system is like, hey, you could be a star, kid, but you need my permission first.
Yeah, exactly.
And that's kind of in the DNA of us as well, where now we're trying to just like, no, you can go and do it yourself.
You can just do it. There's nothing stopping you, you know, like no matter who you are, where you are, like you have the ability to go make your movie. You just need to buckle down and do it, you know.
So. And to be smart about it. Don't go and make $100,000 or $500,000 period drama piece with no stars in it. Expect to make your money back.
Please don't do that.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
Make a genre movie. I mean, I just happen to love genre movies, and that's all I want to make, you know? So like, that's what I do. But I'd say like for your first feature, if you make it a genre movie, you're going to have way better chance at success than if you go with any other genre, like genre drama or even comedy. Comedies are hard, man. You know,
comedies and dramas are just walk around AFM and tell me how many comedies and dramas, not family films, not faith.
No, family films, faith-based and family. Yeah.
Different conversation. Why? Because they're focused on a niche. You know, throw Dean Cain in and have a puppy save Christmas and you've got a movie that's going to sell.
Mm-hmm. You got it made, man.
I mean, the Dog That Saves Christmas movie. I've said it so many times on the show. Make a Dog That Saves Christmas movie. You'll sell it.
Yeah. No kidding. I feel like I've had a couple of filmmakers on who do faith-based and family films, and they're doing good. Let's just say that they're doing really good.
they do well because it's an audience that not a lot of filmmakers focus on, and they need content. That's one area that doesn't have a lot of content. Family films, believe it or not a lot of content. Even romance, like romantic comedies, Hallmark has that kind of covered, but it's just tough, man. It is tough. So the go-tos are always action, thrillers, and sci-fi. And on a lesser extent, horror, obviously, but there's just so much horror.
Yeah.
It's because it's so easy to do a horror movie. Like in the sense of production, not making a good horror movie, but just in the sense of production. Anybody can go get a monster mask, go in the forest, kill a bunch of teenagers, and then you got a horror movie or a scary movie in the house or something like that. And believe me, I've seen that movie too many times.
The thing that's so funny is there's a really good version of that movie that everybody's going to want to watch a billion times. But there's also like 1,000 bad versions of that movie, too. So be careful, people.
Exactly. Look, there's Jaws and there's Sharknado. And I don't know how many times I'm going to watch Sharknado. I've never seen it. I think I've seen clips of it.
But just think of the money, man. Sharknado, woo boy, that was a success beyond success.
But it was, and by the way, it launched an entire genre of the alligator, hurricane, and Velociraptor, Preacher, whatever that movie was. Yeah. And they just started combining crazy things after Sharknado. But when you hear Sharknado, you're like, oh, yeah, I understand what that means. Yeah, it's just.
Yeah, I get it.
Tornadoes with sharks in them. Yeah, I got it. Got it. Done. But if you're going to watch a killer shark movie, which is the one you're going to watch again and again, it's Jaws.
Yeah.
Still holds to this day, even with the fake shark. It's still.
I wonder what our children will be saying about Jaws in 20 years, if they'll be like, yeah, Jaws is so fantastic, or if Jaws is going to die out with our generation.
Man, Jaws is a masterpiece in the sense
it really
that it's just, I think because we don't see the shark so often, and because that's the reason. If we saw a lot of shark, it'd be dated.
Yeah.
But that's one of those movies that you like. It was in the 70s. There's a handful of 70s films that hold. There's a lot, but like the ones that stick out, like especially in the genre range, there's not a lot of genre 70s films. There's great dramas. There's, you know, but like genre, Jaws, obviously Star Wars, movie like Rocky.
Yeah.
Rocky holds.
Rocky's still so good.
So good.
You're a piece of the choir, man. These are all like my favorite movies.
Like, I mean,
Alien 79.
Alien is Alien. I mean, but again, it was done at such a high level at that time. Yeah. So yeah. Jaws is a masterpiece. It is an absolute masterpiece in horror and in thriller, and what Steven was able to do in that film is will never be redone. It's just,
but you think about like what he went through to get that movie made, and like how many days they shot, and like the whole month, the whole shark thing, and it's like, it's crazy, man. It's crazy.
No, it was insane, insane. One day I'll have Steven on the show, and I'll ask.
Yes, please. can I sit in the corner when you have Steven on the show and listen in? I'd love to do that.
I'm sure everybody's gonna want to sit in the corner. I'm gonna want to sit in the corner when I'm on the show one day. So listen, bro, I'm gonna ask you a few questions. Ask all my guests. What advice would you give a filmmaker trying to break into the business today?
Just make your movie. And if it's a short, if you haven't made a short yet, make a couple shorts. If you've made a couple shorts and you want to make a feature, go make a feature. Even if your heart is telling you, I need to make a feature, I haven't never made anything before in my life, make the feature. Just go out and make whatever your heart is telling you to make, because that's what's going to be good. And then that's what you'll learn from.
What is the lesson that took you the longest to learn, whether in the film industry or in life?
I think that, like, you know, you basically don't need permission, you know, like we were talking about before, that you just need to go do it with your team, create your network, create your family, go help you make your movies. Cause like, you're not going to be able to do it on your own. So find those collaborators and stick with them, because they make all the difference.
And three of your favorite films of all time.
Goodfellas, Alien, Terminator.
Solid list, sir. Solid list. I'd throw Alien and Aliens in there both, because they're just masterpieces.
I was going to say Alien and Aliens. I was like, that's too late. I got to throw in another one in there that I love too. So First Terminator.
And Terminator 2 is also another masterpiece as well. But where can people see the alternate and also find out what you're doing and the good work that you're doing?
So if you go to my website, www.ulrichbursell.com, you can find links to the alternate and all the places and everything. It's also, it's on Amazon. It's on Apple TV, iTunes. It's on Vudu. Pretty much any place that you can rent and buy a digital movie, you'll be able to find the alternate. So go look for it and, you know, buy it, rent it, and rate it. Rate it wherever you can, you know, Rotten Tomatoes, you know, whatever, IMDb, Letterboxd, any of the places, ratings would be great. And be honest, I love a good one, but you know, I want your honesty too.
No honesty, just only good ones, please. I don't only care good ones. About honesty.
And then I also have a podcast called Making Movies is Hard. You can find us at makingmoviesishard.com. We are only release one episode a week, unlike Alex, who can manage to release like 1,000 episodes every week. If you love these kinds of podcasts, you might like ours too.
I highly recommend their podcast. It is, I've been a guest on it, a couple times, if I'm not mistaken. Yeah. Twice.
Yeah.
We're due for another one soon. I think we might be doing one.
We might be doing something very special. We can't announce it yet.
I can't say anything. Something's happening.
Maybe something. Yes, exactly.
But listen, Eller, I mean, thank you so much for coming on the show and talking shop with me, and congrats. After this epic long, almost 10 years, almost like what, 8 years?
Yeah, almost 9 years. Made. Almost nine now.
Almost 9 years getting this made. You finally gave birth to this.
Yes,
baby.
Indeed.
Yours. But congratulations, brother. And thank you for all the hard work you do and helping filmmakers out there as well, my friend.
Thanks, Alex. Thanks to you too. And yeah, love your show. And I love all the things you do. And yeah, keep it going, man. Because if you're not around, I don't know what we would do.
I want to thank Ulrich so much for coming on the show and dropping his knowledge bombs on the tribe today. Thank you so much, Ulrich. If you want to get links to anything we spoke about in this episode, including how to see his new film, The Alternate, head over to the show notes at indiefilmhustle.com/622. Thank you so much for listening, guys. As always, keep that hustle going. Keep that dream alive. Stay safe out there, and I'll talk to you soon.
Thanks for listening to the Indie Film Hustle podcast at indiefilmhustle.com. That's INDIEFILMHUSTLE.com.